Welcome to the Security Weekly News wrap-up for the week of 29 May 2022. We've got alarm robots from hell, Atlassian, Windows, Karakurt, Clipminer, Meeting Owl, and show wrap-ups on the Security Weekly News episode 215.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Monitoring and maintaining compliance is a never-ending struggle with a high price of failure. FireMon helps customers meet complex and varying compliance requirements. FireMon has fully customizable reporting, analytics, assessments, and dashboards to meet the compliance needs of any organization. With FireMon, compliance reports take a tenth of the time, and real-time continuous compliance eliminates the anxiety and headaches of audit preparation. Improve security outcomes by improving security operations with FireMon. Visit securityweekly.com/FireMon to learn more.
All right, right now, everyone is talking about cryptocurrency and cyber criminals are hiding in the conversation. Cyber criminals use social engineering loaded with urgency and fear to successfully prey on your company, your employees, and your customers. Spear phishing is just one of the 13 types of email threats, and Barracuda has identified all 13 types and shows you how you can protect your company, your customers, and your reputation. Find out about the 13 email threat types and Barracuda email protection by getting your free book at securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda. All right. I'm Doug White. This is Security Weekly News Wrap-Up Show, episode 215. How about that? And it's June even, so you know, it's like, here we go. This week on Application Security Weekly number 199, John and Mike had Nikhil Gupta, the co-founder and CEO at Armor Code on the show. Nikhil was on talking about how software development has evolved, which is pretty interesting to me, and also about how this impacts the dev teams and sec teams along, you know, with all the shifting left discussions and things like that. So a pretty interesting segment. I'm always interested in you know, sec dev and app dev stuff. But Nikhil went on to talk about the purple book of software security and how that has morphed into a global movement to develop secure software. So a pretty interesting segment if you're a developer or if you're interested in that kind of stuff. And in the second segment, the AppSec News. Business Security Weekly did not have a show this week. And I guess I should have maybe skipped over that. On Enterprise Security Weekly 276, Adrian Cady and Tyler Shields had Matt McGurk, a solution architect at Source Defense, on the show. Matt was on talking about client-side security, so there was a whole lot of stuff about this week, and I ended up talking about it too, and Matt was on several shows talking about it. So definitely an interesting thing to bring up, and we haven't seen a lot of discussion about this, but client-side security in relation to web apps and how, which is really where all that sits for the most part, and how that's such a big vector because the browser is that, you know, that space, and it's going to really change. I mean, it's already changed, of course, but it's going to continue to change all the considerations, the tools, and the knowledge that that is not the same as traditional web app security. They talked about client-side security, why these types of attacks are dangerous, and options for dealing with it. So a good sort of introduction, I think, to web app security stuff if you are not well-versed in that or you're just interested in it. In the second segment, Ian Glazer, the Senior Vice President of Product Management at Identity at Salesforce, was on. And Ian was talking about how Salesforce, very early actually, Salesforce adopted multi-factor authentication requirements for all of their customers back in 2019. Now, they didn't implement that immediately, but they adopted the requirement. You know, so that's quite a while ago. And they were an early adopter of that whole model, and they had a deadline of February of 2022, which is now come and gone. Ian talked about all the challenges that they faced with doing this, and I'm sure they got massive pushback from clients. He talked about some of the problems and what you can learn from their experience with this to implement this in your own organization. And in the third segment, the Enterprise Security News. On Security Weekly News number 214, Jason Wood talked about one of the wackier ransomware things I've seen. Definitely check that out if you're interested in such things. This was about sort of hacktivist type stuff, which is always sort of a strange juxtaposition of morals and ethics and all these kind of things. But this particular ransomware requires you to do good deeds and document them as a ransom. So they literally had requirements, like you had to go out and give blankets to homeless people and take pictures of this and try to document all that on their site as a ransom. Very weird to me. I get it, you know, and I get sometimes people want to do good things, but you know, to me, this is probably not your best approach to this kind of thing. On Paul's Security Weekly number 743, first up was Matt McGurk on a second show this week. And Matt McGurk is a solution architect at Source Defense. Matt was on Paul's Security Weekly to once again talk about client-side attacks, and this time was looking at simulations of those things, how you evaluate this kind of risk on a website, what kind of tech you can use to defend against these attacks, and some landmark attacks that have happened down through the years. Again, a very interesting, I mean, almost everybody has some kind of website or web presence now. And as these client-side attacks grow, and they were talking about supply chain versions of this and so forth, got me very interested in it. I read a lot of different articles about client-side attacks and so forth. And there's a lot of space attack surface here. So definitely check that out. And then, of course, in the new format of Paul Security Weekly, they only have two segments now. So the second segment was the security news. And so my threat of the week then is going to be client-side attacks. Matt McGurk inspired me to read some more about this and think some more about it. I probably had one of the first websites that was ever up, way back. And this was probably like 1998. This person that I always wrote with and did a lot of research with, we built a website. We had a thing called the Cat Cam, which I won't get into what we called that as an experiment. But we literally had a camera that I put on one of my cats on a table, and we were streaming like frames out onto the internet, and it was very interesting to me. And you know, in the old mainframe days, the terminal that people used out, you know, on their desk or wherever they were, was under the complete control of me, your loving sysop. But browsers meant that suddenly you had this sort of standalone doorway on your desktop that is beyond the control of anybody. I mean, it literally is controlled by end users, right? So that browser can be, I mean, you know, depending on how you've locked your organization down, but a browser can literally be on somebody's home desktop, is probably running as an admin, and they may have no idea how it works or what to do about it. And I mean, and if you think about that browser space, it's really a pretty complicated thing, because it's not as simple as an old terminal. It's not as simple as an old website where there was very limited browser space available. Today, there's lots of different browsers. There's lots of different options in any given browser. There's lots of different components to any given browser. And there's even lots of simultaneous threads running in that browser. I mean, the whole concept is just an invitation to, you know, like, abuse me, because that browser has got to get things. You know, so it's definitely reaching out to other sites and downloading things, you know, that are often seamless, that you don't see, that it's being triggered by different scripts, by different code, and it's going to get those things. And once it gets those things, it's going to execute them. And they can be anything from just static, you know, pages to live action kinds of streaming stuff. And all of that is being executed in that browser locally. You know, those original browsers, you know, most people put on their systems that they're running as admin or root. And so whatever they got was executed with that admin privilege locally. And so, you know, that's pretty much game over today. I mean, if somebody can push something onto your desktop and execute it with root privilege, if that browser is not a shell like an old mainframe terminal, it's not contained, that thing can actually touch, you know, just about anything in your system. And so, you know, today there's a lot more stuff that you see if you start looking at browsers and browser security and client-side security in terms of sandboxing, which was something that a lot of us, I used to do that manually, right? I used to do manual sandboxing of websites. So if I had to go to a website I didn't know anything about, or I wanted to download something I didn't know anything about, I literally had throwaway desktops. I used to have a physical machine that I just considered a throwaway. you know, I mean, I would re-ghost that machine probably once a week. And so if I wanted to go to a website to look at something and I didn't know what I was going to look at or what I might experience, there was so little security around that client-side execution. I was really nervous about downloading this, and I wanted to see what it did before I actually went there. You know, if I downloaded something cracked, for instance, I always remember I was downloading this piece of music software, and I didn't want to buy it. I know, I'm just admitting it's statute of limitations probably now. But I had no intention of using it commercially or using it for any purpose other than just I wanted to see what it did. And I downloaded a piece of cracked software, and I put this on a sandbox machine. And the thing was, you know, the website had malware in it. The software had malware in it, and so on. So all those things we've seen start to develop, the sandboxing of the browsers and so forth, is really just trying to prevent that rogue code from executing and having some impact locally. But you know, you can, as we've seen, as we report all the time, there's tons and tons of stuff that can be embedded in legitimate sites and legitimate code. You know, you're expecting legitimate code, but whether it's HTML or JavaScript and on and on and on, you're still basically using a tool on your system, which causes code to execute on your local machine. And I mean, that, you know, that's complexity. It's not in the browser itself. It's not just one window anymore. It's multiple windows that you may not know that, but there's multiple windows. The website may have multiple components. All of them are running different types of material. They're connecting to multiple locations on the internet. They're all uploading and downloading things constantly. And any one of those components could have malware intermingled into that legitimate code, or there could be poisoned DNS. There could be bad links, stolen tokens, on and on and on and on. I mean, it really makes you kind of want to pack your internet bags and move into the woods, you know, and just like, I'm out. Can you imagine me living in the woods? That would be funny for about 9 seconds until I like ate poison berries and died or something. But anyway, we have seen improvements like the removal of automated script execution, or at least the potential removal of that stuff. And the default setups of a lot of browsers have greatly improved. You know, they've added sandbox capabilities that are built in without you having to actually do anything about that, because a lot of us like to fiddle with this stuff, but you know, end users are not capable of that. And you know, when somebody like my father, who's no longer with us, but when my father was around, he had no capability to manage the, you know, the settings and so forth. So you had to have this. And when you have a large group of your employees or people in general accessing just about every site in the world with a browser that can execute code that they have no idea where it's coming from, how it works, how to set it up, how to protect it, you're going to have a lot of client-side attacks. So, you know, and just, you know, just a quick list. I mean, if you just quickly Google client-side attack, you get stuff like mage carding. You know, I mean, and mage carding, of course, is where you use JavaScript to steal information. So, you know, it's basically an overlay. It's grabbing things off of a website as people type them in, and the website itself may be completely legitimate. Form jacking, which is another type of that. To modify a form on a website to try and capture personal information when somebody's typing in something. You know, digital skimming is another. I mean, just the fact that all these terms exist for these different things implies there's an awful lot of threat here. Digital skimming, of course, is another type of overlay where it captures what you're typing. And of course, credential harvesting, which is grabbing things out of that browser as it's being used. So, you know, your credentials are in that browser, you're typing things in. If there's ways around that local security, they may be able to extract that stuff and, of course, you know, do that. Now, I mean, all this requires somebody gets JavaScript to execute locally, you know, likely approved by the user. But again, these users don't know how to deal with this. We've shown that over and over again, that Verizon, I did a Verizon story on Tuesday. You know, they showed 82% of breaches started with, you know, users clicking links or going to places they shouldn't have gone to. And all that can result in any of these types of attack. Now, I mean, we all know when you start disabling features on browsers, it makes end users spend a lot of time and energy calling the help desk to complain that something's not working right. And, you know, and so we tend to then want to not do that. But we probably are all, at least I hope we're all coming to the term that trusting end users not to click on bad things or download bad things, you know, I mean, that's just naive. And some of these mage cart skimming attacks are, you know, they're not even where somebody has to do that. They just execute while you're typing on the site. You didn't have to click it. You didn't have to do anything. And that just means you've got a major problem. So I think all this ultimately leads back to a kind of mainframe mode where you have to sandbox a browser the basic browser operation, and can't allow that browser to run anything locally outside of that shell. So that gets back to looking somewhat like a mainframe terminal model. But when you put all these things in a sandbox, then maybe the script can't necessarily access the system, so at least it helps. It still doesn't help if it's a skimmer type attack or if they type their credentials into something and those can be reused. And of course that leads you back to, you need to be using multi-factor authentication, which could limit that threat. So I guess in the end, it all comes back to defense in depth, but adding sandboxing and multi-factor requirements to the browser can go a long way toward reducing this attack vector. At least that's my opinion of it, you know, from where I'm sitting here in the studio. And now the news. So Atlassian, which is an Australian multinational company that reports that they have 235,000 customers worldwide in over 190 countries with 10 million monthly active users. So, you know, a pretty significant company. I think a lot of people haven't heard of them, but they're a fairly significant company of size. But Atlassian released a security advisory for CVE-2022-26134. And they put this out yesterday, and they said that this vulnerability is being actively exploited to install web shells, and there is no fix available. I mean, that's a pretty ominous statement from a company with that many customers. The vulnerability itself is an unauthenticated remote code execution, and there wasn't a lot of details there about how it works. But basically, it impacts their Confluence server and their data center server. So two big platforms from them, specifically version 7.18 of the Confluence server and 7.4 and higher of the data center server are impacted by this flaw. Atlassian has advised, so listen to this, that servers should be made inaccessible by one of two methods. Either restrict the instances from the internet, okay, or disable the servers. I mean, that's not exactly a message you want to get when you're supporting that many people. So, I mean, it's a pretty severe action, but they say there is no other way to mitigate the vulnerability currently. It did note that Atlassian Cloud is not affected by this vulnerability and that they are actively working on a patch. Which, why do you have to say actively? I mean, if you're working, aren't you actively working? Or is there some kind of inactive work? Oh, that's probably what I do. Yeah, inactive work. But anyway, CISA did add this to their known exploited vulnerabilities catalog and required that all federal agencies block internet traffic to Confluence servers by today. So, you know, Vlexity found the flaw while performing incident response over the weekend. In the breach, they were analyzing the attacker installed Behinder, which is a JSP, a JavaScript web shell, which was then used to install China Chopper web shell as, I guess, a backup to Behinder. So if you find Behinder and remove it, then they've still got another web shell they can come in through. The objective of that attack that they were analyzing seemed to be dumping user tables from Confluence. So they were collecting data out of this massive system. In the article, there's a list of attacking IPs and YARA rules that you can use to detect this attack. But in the meantime, I guess you're going to have to block access to your Confluence and data center servers from Atlassian. So get on that. Windows has yet another zero day, which this one involves SearchMS as well as another one. But SearchMS is a URI protocol handler and basically allows applications and HTML links to launch customized searches on a device. So that already starts to sound like back to what I was talking about client-side attacks. This is another example of something that has to be able to launch a window on a device. So it needs enough privilege to do that. And then what can that window access? It can, but in this case, the attack allows it to open a search window which contains remotely hosted malware. So if they can pop open a window that instead of what you thought you were searching for pops open a window full of malware, then you may click on that. Now, a lot of times people would not allow this. So in the base browser, if you do this, it pops open a warning that says we're trying to open a window. But what this report found was that you could do this via a Word document. So when somebody clicked on the Word document attached to an email, it could pop open this search window, which then is full of malware and can actually be used as a launching app. Yeah, yay. The initial approach then triggers an alert But if somebody clicks on that alert, they might, you know, a lot of people have been trained not to do this. Matthew Hickey from Hacker House found a way to combine an OLE object flaw in Office with the SearchMS vulnerability, which allowed opening that remote search window by clicking on the Word document itself. So it was just triggered by Word, and that pops a search window up that has malware from an offsite location. Yet another zero day at the same time in the Microsoft Windows Support Diagnostic tool was also found by the same group, which also used Word as a launching point to launch the MSMSDT URI protocol handler, which is a different variation of this same thing, which that one allows the execution of PowerShell commands just by opening the document. So they're using that, you know, that vulnerability in the OLE to trigger these other actions, which can then, you know, if you can run a PowerShell command like that, it's pretty much game over. But basically, all this is the same as that SearchMS problem, and it's all about using Word to trigger this. So sending people doc files, which, you know, we all get all the time. I don't like it, but we get them all the time. And, you know, hey, you got mail. Let's see what this is. And, of course, this opens a whole new set of vectors for phishing attacks and so forth. Basically, the mitigation is that you'll have – so they have a mitigation on here. And so use the command line interface to back up and delete the registry key, H key classes root / searchms and also MSMSDT, and then you delete that key. So they back it up so you don't lose it, but then you go in and delete the key altogether. Prevents this from happening. Not necessarily the best approach, and it may have impact on other things, but Microsoft says they're working on fixes, but they made this statement, which was just, you know, thanks. This is a quote statement from Microsoft. This social engineering technique requires a user to run a malicious document and interact with a list of executables from an attacker from a specified network share. We recommend users practice safe computing habits and to only open files that come from trusted sources. Yeah, that'll work. Yeah, no way you're going to get in trouble with that. U.S. federal agencies warned organizations to not pay ransom demands from the Karakurt gang, since paying up didn't stop the gang from selling the stolen data to other groups. Karakurt is the data, and now these things are like, you know, corporations. Karakurt is the data extortion division of Conti ransomware gang. It's like, Karakurt, a division of Conti. Yeah, and they've been around since at least June of 2021. They use the old, if you don't pay up, we dump the data on the dark web for distribution. Yeah, model. Karakurt demands ransoms ranging from $25,000 to $13 million U.S. dollars of Bitcoin that must be paid within a week, or they will start releasing your data. Now, despite the claim that if you pay up, they will destroy the data when the ransom is paid, well, you know, they're criminals after all. I mean, they're a criminal ransomware gang. Did you really expect them to be honest? But apparently they don't live up to this. I will say, though, as a ransomware gang, your reputation is everything. Because if people don't trust you as a ransomware gang, well, they're not going to pay the ransom. So, you know, yeah, they probably should cover that at the ransomware gang training seminar. But along with this caution, the federal agency stated that Conti and Karakurt are well known for exaggerating how much data they actually have to, of course, try to get you to pay. And they said that there were several claims where they actually claimed they had more data than the victim could possibly have stored on all of their servers combined. So, but, you know, they're criminals. They're lying. Imagine that. I mean, I'm always amazed at how people are so shocked that they find out people are lying, especially when, I mean, you know, politicians lying. Oh, no, criminals lying. What's the world coming to? But it is a good notice to read, since you don't want to be paying criminals with bad reputations and such. So, yeah, it was an interesting article to me. Well, in that same light, you've heard of single extortion. You've heard of double extortion, like Karakurt. And now how about triple extortion? This article was talking about triple extortion, which I don't know how, you know, it almost sounded like I made up a term just so I could get more people to read this. But, you know, the secret of being an extortionist, beyond your reputation, of course, because, you know, like if you keep telling people if they pay up, you won't cut Bunny Lebowski's toe off, and then you cut Bunny Lebowski's toe off anyway. You know, but the secret of being a good ransomware gang is getting people to pay, right? I mean, if your reputation is you won't pay, well, you know, or if every time they do pay, you hide more ransomware in the payment string, well, you know, it's like overkill, the goose that laid the golden egg and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But I mean, so since people started figuring out that they needed backups to avoid ransomware, and that's, of course, how you beat single extortion ransomware. It's like, we've encrypted your file. And then, well, double extortion was brought about to help that work. So that's, you know, we're going to leak your data if you don't pay up. We don't care if you got backups. We've got your data. So we're gonna exfiltrate it before we encrypt everything. So then that's Karakurt's model. But triple extortion, according to this article, is where the attacker uses the stolen information to target third party. So actually, yeah, okay, that is a new thing. So they're targeting your customers. You know, so if you don't give them the ransom, not only are they going to release your data, they're going to use your data to target your supplier. So sometimes this was denial of service. It was doxing. It was just going to the customers and saying, you know, do you realize this company you're doing business with is completely incompetent? They've lost all your data. So this article basically talked about this type of attack, which did occur on the American Dental Association by a group called Black Basta. I don't know how you pronounce that, but it's Black Basta ransomware group. Last month hit the American Dental Association. And I mean, if you get hit, you really got to have a plan for this stuff. I mean, and I think this, the reason I mentioned this story was because this triple extortion model is now starting to happen and has been happening. And if your whole plan is to assume you won't get hit, or even today, if your plan is assume you've got backups, it's not going to help. It's pretty naive. So you probably need to revisit your plans. What are we going to do if we get hit by this? We get hit by, you know, double extortion or triple extortion. How are we going to deal with this when it does happen? Trojan.Clipminer is, well, a Trojan, of course, hence the name. And it is used to mine crypto on infected systems, so nothing new there. But beyond being a crypto miner now, this one actually goes so far as to look for wallet addresses in the clipboard. So if it sees you actually, you know, copying wallet addresses to the clipboard, it can then redirect that transaction to a different wallet. So it intercepts that clipboard information, changes it to be one of their wallets. Apparently, this started happening back in January of 2021, but Semantics this week said that there's a lot of similarities between Clipminer and CryptoSabula, or however you say that, which debuted a few months before that, way back in 2021. This report this week said that Clipminer this year so far has stolen at least $1.7 million using this technique. Clipminer is typically spread in wares. So if you're downloading cracked games, cracked wares, pirated software, whatever, you know, one, nobody's going to have much sympathy for you when you get hit. And two, you're probably going to get hit with this kind of stuff. But basically, a Clipminer is, it drops a WinRAR archive onto the host from the cracked extraction, and then has a DLL in it that has a downloader, which is hidden in the registry with another name. It then collects details about the system, looks to see if there's a blank registry key where it's already been hit, and then it basically phones home over Tor. Once that all happens, it creates a scheduled task and adds that empty registry key to prevent reinfection of the device. But basically, look, if you download wares, and you shouldn't, but if you do, you better put them on that burner machine or that sandbox machine first, because I'm telling you, every time I looked at those things, and yes, I've looked at them, they are completely filled with goodies for the unsuspecting. You should probably have a standing warning to all your people that you remind them regularly. Please don't download wares. You know, I know it's tempting. I know that $8,000 piece of audio software that you're really interested in, but you don't really intend to buy, and you just want to check it out to see how it works, is tempting. But if you're going to do those things, you need sandboxing capability, and you need that stuff to be very isolated, or you're going to get got. Well, if you purchased and are using Meeting Owl Pro, I saw that. I was like, what? And this thing is apparently a mess. The article details a long list of weaknesses, including some juicy ones, like it exposes the names, email addresses, IPs, and locations of all the users in an online database that's like got unrestricted access. It has Bluetooth with no passcode for easy proximity attacks. It can be turned into a rogue access point quite easily. And images of the whiteboards for your meeting can be captured. Well, Mod Zero Security found all those threats while they were analyzing video conferencing solutions. The Meeting Owl product was made by Owl Labs in Massachusetts. Apparently, they're really into owls. And Owl Labs said that they had no knowledge of any breaches due to this these problems, and that they are planning specific updates available this month to begin correcting these problems if you've already bought one of these things. In the short run, you might want to put your Meeting Owl back in its cage. And yeah, the product does kind of look like a cyberpunk owl. It looked kind of cool. I mean, I don't have one, and I don't want to buy one right now. But you know, it was pretty interesting looking. And finally, you know, I'm really good at waking up. Really, I always have been. I hardly ever have to have an alarm. I can literally think about when I need to wake up, and I usually wake up, you know, like around about that time. Unless it's something really weird, like I have to get up at 4 a.m. or something to go to the airport, or I have to get up at 6 or any of those kind of things. But even then, I'm usually pretty good at it. You know, a couple times I woke up and thought, wow, the sun's kind of, I remember this, I was in Munich. I was like, wow, the sun's kind of high for this early in the morning. It's like, oh, hell no. Like, I just overslept by 4 hours. Yeah, and then you spend the next hour running through the streets of Munich in the snow trying to get to the airport somehow. But anyway, one of my old roommates had like 6 alarm clocks, and they would all be going off, and they were all like spaced further and further away from his bed. And then, you know, one would start going off, and then he would throw it on the floor, and then, you know, the other one would go off, and it, you know, it was like, oh, this is killing me. But anyway, this article was about something called the Pavlok Shock Clock. Say that real fast 3 times. It's a $150 bracelet that you wear while you're asleep, and when your alarm goes off, well, how about a nice electroshock to the arm to wake you up, or wherever you want to wear this bracelet? We will get into that. According to the article, the shock bracelet is supposed to train you into compliance to recognize a normal alarm signal, you know, like a bell or a buzzer that should wake you up. But now, because you get shocked whenever you hear the bell or the buzzer, it's a Pavlovian thing, right? Only you don't start drooling. You wake up screaming every day. Sounds lovely. I mean, nobody likes the alarm to go off, but if you're getting a big-time electric shock, I'm sure it's not a big-time electric shock. But, you know, I guess if you're one of those people that never hears the alarm, it might work. I mean, it seems to be a big business, because this article reported that there's a super loud alarm called a screaming meanie that apparently has a volume level akin to a World War II air raid siren and generates police calls and, you know, complaints from the neighbors. And then there's another thing, which, you know, I've seen these where the light slowly gets brighter in the room, you know, like dawn in the cave or something like that. I guess whatever it takes to get you up. There's even a robot in this article called Clocky, which apparently, like, you know, when it wants to wake you up, it starts doing stuff. Yeah. My dad used to throw cold water on my brother, but that didn't really work that well either. Best way, I got one for you. Get a cat. The cat will definitely wake you up using a wide variety of methods, which are often effective, including claws in your skin, biting, wailing, or what we call singing, vomiting on you, climbing the blinds, breaking things, turning over glasses of water. You know, it's a cat. And that's the wrap-up for the week of 29 May 2022. I'm Doug White. Next week is RSA, so there will be no shows. So I'll see you in the Tuesday following. Well, yeah, or something like that. Anyway, have fun at RSA.